This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And boy, do we have a special guest today, David Baldacci. Yes, New York Times number one bestseller. And his new book is the second in the Amos Decker series. It's called The Last Mile. Hello.
Hello.
It's nice to talk to you.
Same here. Good to be back.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I don't even remember what book we talked about last time. I wish I had a better memory than like that.
Yeah.
As an author, do you have a good memory?
You know, I remember things that I really need to know. Other things, not nearly as well. That's what I rely on my wife for. She remembers pretty much everything that's of importance. For me, the books are the important thing, so I remember that.
Yeah, that's what you have to keep track of all the characters and all the situations and what they did before. That's got to be hard because the readers are always up on those things.
They are. And I, you know, sometimes I'll go back and read through previous books of the series to make sure that I keep things consistent.
You're an amazing storyteller. I mean, this is a great new series. This is probably my favorite of your series.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And I'm not just saying that because it's the new book. People are probably thinking, well, he's just saying that. He doesn't really mean that. I do. Memory Man was so incredible and such an incredible start to the series. Where did this idea all come from?
Well, you know, I'd always been fascinated by the mind. It's the most powerful organ we have. It can literally trap you in your own body. You know, if you have an eating disorder, it can convince you you're morbidly obese, even if you're deathly thin. It can convince you that if you don't go through this elaborate counting ritual before you leave the house, something bad will happen to you if you have OCD. Totally irrational stuff. The mind overpowers you. And so I thought, well, let me have a character who has some type of really terrific mental ability, and the backstory was that he was nearly killed on the football field from a blindside hit, brain trauma, his brain rewired itself, and he came out of it with perfect recall or hyperthymesia, which is a real condition, and you can either be born with it, like the actress Mary Lou Henner was, or you can acquire it through brain trauma. And that just is a lot of emotional baggage for this guy, because not only did his memory become perfect, his personality changed. He was a different person before, but because his brain changed, and the brain controls personality, he became a totally different person, even though he's in the same body. So that really made for a lot of great material for a complex character.
Wait, did you get to meet Mary Lou?
No, I didn't, but I've seen her interviewed about her condition over the years. And again, as an actress, I guess it's a phenomenal attribute to be able to look at the script one time and memorize it totally, never have to look at it again.
That would be an incredible, incredibly big help to these. I wonder how they do it. I mean, you look at these shows and like, how do they know when to talk and when, what to say and how do they do it so well? They make it look easy.
Yeah, and that's why they're professionals. We just watch with our mouths open.
So how easy is it for you to write? Let's talk about it being easy here.
You know, some days are easier than others. When I really got everything clear in my head and I'm just rolling and the words are just flying out of me, and it's a great feeling. Other days, you know, you're kind of like stumbling along, not really sure where you want to go. Your ideas aren't working. The words aren't translating onto the screen or the piece of paper like you want them to. So that can be very frustrating. So it's never the same day.
And you write two books a year. I know you do. And that must be really, really tough. I mean, a lot of authors only write one a year. So you have it extra hard.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, but I also love to do it. And I feel comfortable with a two-book pace year because I'm writing all the time anyway. So, you know, for years before, I would write a book, and then I'd write a screenplay, which took a long time as well. And then I decided, you know what, I'm just going to kind of stick to novel writing. And the two-book pace year fit for me. I never treat it as a job. I don't count words or pages so I can have this artificial goal so when I hit it, I can get up and get out of there. I just write each day until my tank is empty.
Right. Well, Amos is such a fascinating character. He's an angry man. He's very, very angry.
Yes, he's got a lot going on inside of him, and people think, well, it'd be really cool to have a perfect memory, but the thing is, he has a lot of things he'd rather forget, and he can never forget them, and that buy-in in itself, you know, makes him angry. And the fact that his brain is rewired, so he's almost on the autism spectrum, where he doesn't really relate to people, doesn't really enjoy being around them, can't pick up on social cues, doesn't have much of a filter, doesn't really get gossip or humor anymore. He knew that at one point in his life he got all those things, and the fact that he lost it and he had no control over that, I think, does make him angry.
He does seem to feel something for other people, though, in your books. I mean, just the two that I've read. There is some kind of a, isn't there?
Yes, there absolutely is, and that is the vestiges of who he used to be. And that's why I love creating and bringing this guy back in more books, because I'm going to keep peeling away the layers of the onion to see if Amos Decker can get back close, not all the way, but close to what he used to be. You know, it's there. He has to really dig deep for it, and it's not going to be easy.
Right. So are you going to do a book a year on Amos? Is that the plan?
For the foreseeable future, yes, because one, I have a lot that I want to say about him, and I'm really enjoying being with him. It's almost like this guy's recharged my batteries in a way. He's so different from any other character that I've written that I really enjoy seeing him on the page.
Now, do you have a psychologist helping you out with this, or making sure you have everything right? Or?
Yeah, I have friends who are psychologists and psychiatrists, one in particular that, you know, I've done a lot of interviews with over the years, and so it allows me to sort of deeply dive into that field and to the psychosis of what this person might be experiencing, the correct medical terms, and also to lay it out in a way that, you know, is plausible, makes sense, and is accurate. So yeah, I do that.
You've come a long way from Absolute Power. That was your first big book, which and just completely took off. You've become very, very, very successful. What did it feel like then? What does it feel like now?
You know, back then when everything was so new and fresh, it was like every day something really cool was happening. It was a phenomenal feeling, very surreal and almost like it was dreamlike. And I was, you know, I remember I would keep waking up thinking, I'm just a lawyer, you know, still. None of this happened to me. And you kind of break into a cold sweat, and then you realize, oh, well, it did happen to me. And now it's not that much different. I mean, every day brings a new surprise. And, yeah, I have written a lot of books, and so that part is not as quite as fresh as it used to be. But I just get a kick out of being able to do this and, you know, do it for a living and getting up every day and being able to explore things that I want to explore.
You must get recognized on the street because you've lived in Virginia for a number of years, correct?
Yeah, I do sometimes. We're not real. I tell people we're like anonymous celebrities, even though it sounds like an oxymoron, because most people don't ever look at the picture on the book. The name gets recognized a lot, I have to say. It's an unusual name. It's not many Baldacci's walking around, but usually it's this, you know, when they see the credit card or they see the driver's license or whatever, the piece of paper I've had to sign at some store, they'll look down, look up, and they'll say, "Do you know the author?" And my pat answer is, "I know him better than anyone."
You have such an incredible sense of humor, and the reason I know that is because I saw you at an event in Chester County a couple of years ago where you were just phenomenally funny. And you don't think of authors as funny a lot of times because, you know, the authors, you think, well, they write a lot, so they're by themselves a lot. So how do they get to be so funny? But you're very funny and personable. Where did that come from?
You know, I guess as a kid, I was very outgoing and loved to tell stories and liked to perform. And I think as a lawyer, you know, as a trial lawyer, you really are a performer. You're getting up and you're making an argument, but you're also trying to convince people that they should trust you and believe what you're saying. And because of that, you just really have to, you know, bring it. The humor, I love humor. I love to make people laugh. I love to laugh. My best lines and my best stories are the self-deprecating ones where I'm sort of the butt of the joke, and I love to do that. And it's been a part of my life for a long time, and I like to get out. It's a nice balance between the time that I sit in isolation writing and having no interaction with anyone and being able to go out and do my little performances and make people laugh. It's just this nice balance, because that's where I get out and I get to talk to actual people.
Because I know of authors before events where they get really, really nervous in front of all those people. And I know that I've actually done it, too. I had one where I contributed some trivia questions for an event, and I was a nervous wreck beforehand, thinking of all those people that were going to be watching me and watching everything I did. So it's not easy. It's not. I mean, you really get nervous.
Yeah, you do. My wife, you know, she's a good speaker, but she dreads public speaking. And with our foundation, she has to do that sometimes, dreads it, and always looks at me and kind of, you know, punches me in the arm. And, you know, why do you make it look so easy? And I guess I've been doing it for so long. And as a lawyer, you know, if you don't want to get up in front of people and talk, you know, I shouldn't become a trial lawyer. And that's what I was. So at least I had that grounding. But again, I think it just comes back to when I was a kid and I loved to perform in front of other people. Right. I never really got nervous about it.
And you're very comfortable doing it. I remember when I was at the event, I was just feeling so comfortable with all the humor. And that, I think that's a big part of it, the fact that you're not afraid to include yourself in all that, too. A lot of people, you know, they don't want to show their vulnerabilities, but you don't seem to care.
No, I know. I'm like, I have so many of them, why not let everybody in on the joke?
That's right. As long as you admit them, it's like you deaden the pain a little bit, you know. It's like,
you do. Lowering the bar is sometimes a very smart thing.
I mean, I think the figure is what is it, 110 million copies of your books in print? Is that what it is?
Something like? I mean, I think that's probably an old number. The last number of my publishers kind of calculated all that. It's like almost 150 million books sold.
Is it really now that much?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's
that's a staggering number.
It is, I know. And believe me, when I started out writing in my career as a short story writer, you know, if one other person actually somehow read it in a dentist's office in a magazine, I would have been thrilled. So this has exceeded my, you know, wildest expectation.
All right, let's talk about The Last Mile. This is the new one. And you always have a great picture on the back of your books. You really, there is something about you. I remember I saw you at the book festival in Washington, D.C. with your kids 1 year. And,
yes.
And you were sitting there, and your kids were sitting right next to you. I'm sure you remember this day. And all I could think of was, wow, what a wonderful guy. He must really love his kids if they're at the event with him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. My kids love books, and they, you know, they're grown now, but back then, too, it was kind of a wonderment for them. Like, what's Dad actually do, you know? And, you know, for the longest time, my daughter just thought that I signed books and people paid me to put my name in a book. She had no idea why people would pay me, but that was a pretty good job.
It was like, yeah, let it keep going, you It was a great day, and I just remember your smiling kids, and I thought, that's so cool. You know, yeah. It's like, you don't see that every day, and it was just something, and I think it was a little bit of a warm day that day, too. It usually is at those book festivals, but...
It can be in D.C., absolutely.
So, tell people what The Last Mile is about. Let's talk about The Last Mile.
Well, Amos Decker's, you know, finished what he needed to do in Memory Man. He solved the murder of his family, so he's moving east to Quantico, Virginia, to work with the FBI on a task force that investigates cold cases. And on the way there, it's the last day of the year, New Year's Eve, and I did that because symbolically he's taking a brand new direction in life. This is a fresh start for him, so a brand new year. And he has an NPR station on his car, and at the top of the hour, this story comes up about this guy named Melvin Mars, who was a legendary football player in Texas, high school, and All-American in Texas, was a lock for the NFL draft. Decker actually played one game against him when he played for Ohio State in college. And Melvin Mars was like this once-in-a-generation freakish athlete, and he would have gone top five in the NFL. But right before the draft, he was arrested, convicted, and condemned to death for murdering his parents. And he's been rotting in prison for 20 years now, and obviously his NFL dream long since gone without ever having played a down in professional football. And he's about to be executed by the state of Texas in last-second reprieve because of prisoner on death row in Alabama has come forward and has confessed to murdering Mars's parents 20 years ago. So the similarities to Decker's family's case, where a guy 16 months later came forward and confessed to the crime, are just eerily familiar and similar. So he decides, you know what, when I get to the FBI, this is the case I'm going to be an advocate for taking, because I want to solve this case.
It's exciting to think of this series playing out. I mean, I just reading the two books, I'm totally excited for the third. That's one of the problems we have as readers, is we want more.
I know. I've been getting, but looking at a lot of the reviews online, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and with this book, it did seem a lot of the comments are, I read it in one night, read it in two nights, and, you know, when's the next one coming? And, you know, I said, I really wish I could write them as fast as you can read them, but I can't.
Well, how much research do you do? I mean, what do you do?
I will go to the places, for the most part, that I write about, if I possibly can. Talk to people in the various fields that I need to talk to. If I can go on out, you know, on the road with people to sort of see how they do their jobs, I'll do that as well. I want to get it right. I don't want to just Wikipedia stuff or just make it up. Particularly if I'm talking about a criminal investigation, if I'm talking about, you know, the criminal justice system, which I knew a lot about, obviously, from being a lawyer, death row inmates, and things like that. So it was, you know, as much firsthand research as I can bring to a particular story, I will.
You must have had a very happy childhood.
My childhood was filled with adventures and imagination and playing outside all the time and reading tons of books. My mom and dad were sticklers to every week. Every Saturday we went to the public library and we checked out, both my brother and sister and I, as many books as we possibly could. And I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, never really traveled outside the city or state when I was a kid. But I sort of traveled the world through books. And I'm a writer today because I was a reader as a kid, and I fervently believe that. So that's why I think, you know, every home should have lots and lots of books in it.
Well, yeah, what you do for reading is amazing. I mean, I hear all the books that you get collected and the things that you do are just absolutely amazing, getting people to read and making, you know, and that's got to be a great feeling to be able to help as much. And the fact that your name is such a big name really, you know, lends a lot of credibility to it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that reading is the most fundamental skill, and it goes far beyond a skill. It really helps define who we will turn out to be, whether we reach our potential in our job, whether we reach our potential as being a parent or a family member, and also just a good person, you know, and being able to vibrantly participate in the democracy. You know, you read stuff on your own and make up your own mind about important issues instead of having people tell you what you're supposed to think. All of that begins with reading. If you don't have that skill, you're cooked. You know, you're never going to hit your potential, and you're going to go through life just half living.
There was recently Downton Abbey had a character who wasn't able to read, and it was a very powerful thing to watch. I don't know if you saw it, but
I did see it. He was the new footman, and I think when Thomas came and said, you know, what book are you reading, and he had a couple, and he said, I'm reading the red one, not the title, and
right.
So that's when Thomas realized.
Very powerfully done, and you really, your heart goes out to anybody who can't read. You just go, well, what would that be like if I couldn't read a book? Like, if I couldn't experience, you know, the power of a book.
Right. And plus, just getting through daily life, how do you do that? I mean, how do you know what bus to get on or what prescription medicine to take?
Right.
Or just getting through a job.
It's just, do you have as much fun writing books as you do reading them?
Yes, I do. I mean, I love being lost in the imagination of somebody else when I'm reading. And when I'm in a book I'm really enjoying, I can't wait to get home, jump in a chair, pull it out. It's like getting dessert over and over again. And I sort of have that same feeling when I'm sitting down writing. I mean, ultimately, I know that people hopefully will have that same experience with my books. Well, they'll run home and jump in a comfy chair and open it up and start reading and just lose themselves completely. But as I'm writing, and that's kind of what I do, the outside world, you know, no longer exists for me. I'm just, it's all in my head, and I'm in the story, and I'm participating in it, and I'm right there.
Yeah. I mean, and it shows, and especially with these two books. I mean, I really have enjoyed these two books, and you know, and it's going to be a long year waiting for the next book. I can tell you right now, but it's like you think I'm joking about that, but I'm not. I really,
no.
I'm looking at all the series that you have, and you've had, according to this, 4, 5, 6, 7, like 7 different. No, these are standalone, so there's like 6 different series.
Yes.
How do you decide what series to go to next? I mean, how does that come about? I mean,
you know, it's not a really long deliberation. Like with the Amos Decker series, I knew that I was going to be with him at least once a year, probably every spring, for maybe, you know, 4 or 5 years. So, one, I just am excited about writing this character and want to get back to him. I don't want to wait a couple of years before I see him again. And two, it's a good way to establish the character for readers so they, you know, have a good foundation for that. And then the other part really comes into, well, if I have an idea for a plot and it's not going to be a standalone, then you start thinking about which series characters will be the best appropriate for to use. It'll be the Camel Club or Will Robey or John Puller or King and Maxwell. And then you sort of have that sort of deliberation because you don't want to take a series character and put it into a plot. It's just not made for them. It's not right for them. And it might be better for somebody else. So I go through that deliberation and then come out the other end and decide, okay, this is what I'm going to do, this story with this character.
Right. I remember when I read True Blue, I was hoping that was going to be a series, and it didn't become a series. And I thought, well, why didn't he make this a series? It would have been a good series.
I know. And, you know, and Mace Perry may come back in another book. My interest went to other things, and I just, you know, moved on. And so that's, it's not, there's no really grand plan to say, well, you know, I finished this book, I'm definitely going to bring a person back as a series. That one actually is in development for a network television series. We'll see, you know,
really?
To the small screen. People, yeah, quite a few people out there really related to that book, and they love the sister relationship, where you don't really, most network television, you have a guy and a girl, or a guy and two guys.
Yeah.
You almost never have two women being the leads. It's just not done, and so they love that sort of unusual relationship.
Except for Rizzoli and Isles.
Except for Rizzoli and Isles, exactly right. I think that's the only one.
But my problem with that show is I don't like Isles. I don't like her at all. I just find her, she gets on my nerves so much, I can't watch the show to a certain extent.
I remember her from, she was Kate from NCIS. I loved that. And when she got killed on that show, I was kind of like, oh my God, can't believe they did that.
And they're doing that a lot lately.
They are, aren't they?
So I'm curious about the Camel Club. Is the Camel Club done?
No, they're not. They're going to be back for at least one more book, but it's going to have to be something really epic. And I'm still working on it. I'm still feeling around the edges of what that story might be, and maybe tying up some of the characters, particularly, obviously, Oliver Stone. So at least one more book.
Not the Oliver Stone. This is your Oliver Stone.
My Oliver Stone.
I remember reading that. But how can I use that name, you know? Hasn't that name already been used somewhere?
I know. It was very much a tip of the hat to the director.
Is there any interest yet in making Amos come to the screen at all? Any screen?
Yes, there is. In fact, I just had a conference call Monday with a feature film, huge feature film producer, director, who wants to take this and develop it as a television series. He read both books. He read Last Mile before it even was published, and just thinks Amos is an extraordinarily complex character. It would be terrific on television, maybe as a serialized, you know, where he might follow one case the entire year, like True Detective, but really focus on the character. He thinks viewers would tune in every week to watch him.
And like you were saying before, I can't wait to get into the mind of him more, Amos, because he's such a fascinating human being. I mean, the things he can figure out and how he figures them out. But that makes your job harder, because you have to come up with these scenarios that are really interesting for readers.
It is, you know, and it is not easy, because it has to be, because he's such an original character, you know, his take has to be original. He has to look at things and, you know, see things that other people just don't see. And that takes time. I don't, you know, I don't have hyperthymesia, but I really have to put myself in the position of, okay, if I did, how would I see things? These little tiny things, you know, like in Memory Man, there were like little pictures on a mantle. And for him, in his mind, he remembered that, but not because of what most people would look those pictures for. And for him, it jogged something else that allowed him to go forward and get a clue and then move on. So it's a lot of work, but you know, I love doing it.
Now, Memory Man, did that go right to number one on the?
It went right. It was number one book in the country. In fact, Last Mile, I just found out 2 days ago, not only did it hit number one on the New York Times, it was the number one best-selling book in the country of all books.
That's amazing! Congratulations on that.
No, I appreciate it. I never take that for granted, and I hit number one in the United Kingdom as well. So at the same time,
What's amazing about you, David, is you seem so well grounded. I call you David like I know you. We're not friends or anything. I mean, a lot of authors, you know, I wouldn't say a lot, but I have met some that are very full of themselves, and you're not like that at all. You're very, very easygoing. You're very personable, and when people meet you, and I've met you, so I know you instantly feel comfortable, and that's important for a reader.
Oh, it is. And that's my, you know, my personality was long since set by the time I became a published novelist. I wasn't going to change who I was. I was comfortable with my skin, my own skin back then, and I'm equally comfortable. I'm not going to change my personality because I've had some success, you know, in writing. And I like people, you know, and I like to make people feel comfortable. I was raised that way, to be polite and respectful, and there's no reason in the world to try to make yourself seem better than other people. I'm not. I have a job, you know, I write for a living, but I love being around people and like having a good time and making people feel good.
And you entertain so well. I mean, and to be able to entertain millions of people, 110 million, I mean, 150 million now you said. It's like, that's such a staggering number. It's just amazing.
I know, I can't either. I tend not to even think about it. And it's just... you know, I write the stories, and, you know, I go out on tour, and this has been a really good tour, and met so many wonderful readers and people who have just enjoyed the books over the years. And you also get the funny things where, you know, you'll get a guy, you know, in his 30s who'll walk up and say, "Mr. Baldacci, I've been reading you since I was in elementary school." I'm like, "Thank you very much. I'm going to walk over to the corner now and cut my wrists."
Well, after you wrote Absolute Power, did you know you were going to be a writer like this? I mean, did you know you were going to write a lot of books?
Well, I knew I had a lot of books that I wanted to write. I just didn't know. You know, if Absolute Power had not been successful, back then, you know, the publishing, probably still today, if, you know, you get one shot. And if the book didn't sell, I probably was not going to have another book published. People were going to say, "Oh, you know, nice try," and go back to being a lawyer. So I didn't know. I had no, you know, firm belief that it was all going to take off for me. I just kind of kept my head down and promoted the book, you know, as best I could. Luckily for me, people liked the book a lot and allowed me to write more. So I feel very fortunate.
One of the ones that really resonated with me was The Winner. That was about the lottery winner. And you say yes, like a lot of people have told you that.
A lot of people. I know Absolute Power was a huge bestseller, but I have to tell you that so many people come up to me and say, "The first book of yours I read was The Winner." I mean, so many people have told me that. So, yeah, I get that winner a lot. I still get emails from people about, you know, "Can you bring Luann back? I know Jackson, you know, the villain, didn't survive, but can you bring him back from the dead? Because he was kind of cool."
Really?
Yeah.
Well, is it difficult to write a character after years of not writing anything on them?
Yes, it actually is. And you just have to, it's not like really, you know, falling off a bike and getting back on and riding it. You have to immerse yourself back in that world and that you created again, and get comfortable with the character. You know, years apart is like a real person. If you've known somebody intimately for a long time and then you haven't seen them for 5 or 6 years, you may come back at one level and say, "Okay, you know, we're connected because we've known each other such a long time, even though we've been away." But at another level, a lot has happened in those intervening years. You know, so you don't know the person as well as you did know the person, and it's going to be a little bit different. So for me, I've got to get back into that character and back into that world really well before I can sit down and start writing about that character again.
It's funny. I mean, it must be like a juggling act for you for all these different series and keeping track of who's on. I don't want to put the wrong character in the wrong book. And I mean, it seems so. You laugh about it, but it's got to be difficult at times.
No, it totally is. It is quite a juggling act. But fortunately, having created the characters, it's not like I'm really going to forget them. But you know, you never want to cross the streams. You know, when I'm writing, I joke to people, and I'm writing a young adult book, and I'm writing a thriller. I said, "Don't let the streams cross, for God's sakes." You know, I don't want to scare little Billy into like a panic attack.
That's right. Because you write children's books too.
I do. Yeah, the fantasy series that I do with Scholastic, the Vega Jane series, and that's been really popular. And the last one, The Keeper, the second installment of that's been on the New York Times list for 23 weeks now. So,
wow.
I like this. I love fantasy, reading fantasy when I was a kid, and I wanted to write fantasy at some point and decided to take the plunge with that first one. And it took me 5 years to write the book because it was a lot of research and a lot of thinking and a lot of fits and starts. But when I sold it to Scholastic under a pseudonym, I wanted the publisher to buy it, not for my name, but for the story. So when they found out it was actually me, they were quite surprised. So that was a blast. Having a lot of fun. They're a great publisher. I love them.
They were surprised. We didn't know David Baldacci could write other stuff. You know?
I know, exactly. And they also thought, the way the book was written, they thought I was a Brit.
Really?
Yeah. So it had very much English, you know, English vernacular and terms and jargon in that. And it was just sort of told, because I love all things Brit. I'm just a huge fan of the British humor and British life and all that. And so that was a lot of fun, and it's been great, you know, going to book signings where now, you know, kids are coming up, kids are young at the book signs, and I'm looking at them, I go, you know, "Oh, you're obviously a reader," and they say, "Oh yeah, I love to read," and I said, "Never lose that. If you have Aww. Books, you'll always have friends."
And the wonderful thing about reading is that you can talk to other people about what you've read and get their opinion, too. And nobody ever agrees on everything. You know, you always find people who totally disagree with what you say. And I think that it's such a wonderful thing, even if they disagree. You still, the discussion you get going is just amazing. I mean, I think people forget that. They don't realize that, you know, "Oh, I have to read a book." I mean, some people think of it as a chore reading, but it should never feel that way.
And I'm big into, I know that, you know, schools and classrooms have to have assigned reading from time to time, but I'm also a big proponent of empowering the kids to choose some of their own books to read as well, where they get to go out and make that selection. So you know that they're reading something they're really interested and excited, because you never want to turn kids off from reading books because you tell them what they have to read.
Well, and I think about, because I used to work at the bookstore, and when we had the summer reading, I remember they had Cormac McCarthy. I'm like, wow, that's pretty powerful stuff for a child to be reading, even a middle-aged kid.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, it is. And again, I get some of that, but there's got to be a balance. And I know it, as a kid, when I would go to the library, I had reading lists, you know, for classes and stuff, but the best part of going to the library for me was going through the shelves and just discovering a book that I didn't know existed before I walked in there, and it looked interesting, and I picked it up and took it home and read it and loved it because, you know, I had picked it. I had made that selection. It was based on things I was interested in. That's how you empower kids. That's how you make lifelong readers.
You still feel that same way?
Oh, my God, yeah. I love to read. And, you know, the coolest thing for me is to read a book by an author that I really enjoyed and then discovering that there's this whole huge backlist, you know, books, previous books. Then I was like, oh, my God, am I kidding, a candy store? And you just jump in and you just read, read, read.
Yeah, it is a thrill. I mean, and you think about, I mean, I love to sit and read in a park. You can just sit and watch the leaves come down or whatever, whatever's happening around you.
Yeah.
And you instantly feel this sense of sereneness, I mean, this wonderfulness. I'm enjoying something so much, and yet I'm watching the world around me, too.
Right. I mean, I've always felt that people read a lot. More people read, we'd have a much better world.
So you said Amos is going to be, do you think it's going to be a TV series within the next couple of years?
Well, if it's going to be, it certainly will be within the next couple of years. That's, you know, it's particular times where you pitch TV series to network, in particular, there's a narrow window there, and also cable. This is probably will be not broadcast network, it's not like the Big Four.
Right.
But more, you know, if you like a Netflix or AMC, where you can do edgier stuff. So, yeah, if it's going to happen, there's no guarantee, but certainly you got a lot of passionate, you know, well-connected people behind it. It'll be in the next couple of years.
So who do you picture Amos looking like, celebrity-wise?
Yeah, somebody had read The Last Mile of the book, and they came up to me and said, "Hey, you know, do you think Dwayne the Rock Johnson would want to play Amos Peck?" And I said, "Well, if he wants to put on 150 pounds, sure."
That's right. I don't know that he wants to do that, though.
I don't think he wants to do. So it would be sort of the antithesis of a classic Hollywood leading man. That is not Amos Decker. So it would have to be, you know, I think about like a big guy who, like a Vincent D'Orofino, who was on Law and Order: Criminal Intent, that kind of quirky,
right,
you know, intelligent but big guy. I'm not saying he was obese, but he's just a big guy. You know, somewhere along those lines. So maybe it could be a new person, a new face that people might have been a character actor, whatever, but nobody really knows who that person is. That might be it. So it'll definitely be interesting casting, that's for sure.
You definitely will. And they, well, I mean, you want, with a TV show, you want all the things have to work together. In other words, all the actors and actresses have to be good. Because if you have one bad one, it can ruin the whole series.
Oh, absolutely right. The chemistry is critical. And
I mean, how did they do it with Mad Men? I mean, look at Mad Men, a TV show that where if there's one bad character, it could ruin everything.
Absolutely. And I think that's why, you know, people spend so much time on casting and sometimes will wait and put a project off until the actor they really want is freed up from another obligation. And because they know the success of it depends on, well, people want to keep coming in every week to watch this group of people interact. And again, if you have one sort of weak, you know, weak part of it that people don't relate to, you could destroy the chemistry of the whole show.
Right. And even a little kid can ruin it. If the kid's not halfway decent, you know, you get these little kids on some of the shows that they're on, and you think, well, how do they get that kid to act, you know?
They're so, yes.
They even know what acting is at that age, you know?
I know.
But they do it so well, and some of them are so cute, you can't help but fall in love with them. So yeah, maybe you forgive them a little bit if they're not the best actor in the world.
That's right. You know, cuteness can be forgiven. given a lot.
I was watching the girl who's on Bones, who plays Bones' daughter, and she's so adorable. And just I just enjoy listening to her. I mean, it's so much fun to listen to her.
Yeah.
It's amazing what little things can mean a lot in life. I mean, it's true of a lot of different things. What would we find you watching on TV if we were looking in your window?
You know, I like some of the network shows that I like. I've been an NCIS fan for a long time. I just like the camaraderie and the chemistry of those actors. Breaking Bad, I was a big fan of Breaking Bad. That was a really, really cool show. My wife is very much into Outlander. She's a big Diana Gabaldon fan. I like True Detective and when it came out. And so, you know, I don't watch a whole lot of television, but the ones that I like...
Did you get through the second season of True Detective? Because I didn't.
I did not. No, unfortunately, I did not.
I was a mess. It really was a mess.
Well, I think they got a little too cute with the formula, and it just they forgot about the story, and it was all about the style of the
But that first season was amazing.
First season was absolutely amazing, yeah. So, and I like PBS and a lot of the British mysteries. I'm a big Midsummer Murder. Also, Cumberbatch on Sherlock Holmes. I love him, and so those are great shows.
And Grantchester. I don't know if you've seen Grantchester yet.
I've heard a lot about it. I'm also a Doc Martin fan too. The doctor in the rural village in Cornwall.
Oh yes, I don't think I've seen those, but I've heard about that.
They are hilarious. You should check it out definitely.
But yeah, I think what makes Grantchester interesting is the camaraderie between the two men on the show. Now, you would say, well, you see that a lot, but this is a different. There's almost like a bromance going on there.
Oh, okay.
So it's even more interesting how they do it, and you just for some reason you just instantly love. And the housekeeper is amazing. she's just the most ornery person. She's like almost like Mrs. Danvers on Rebecca. But she's not quite that bad, but she's fascinating. You got to check it out. I mean, it's just an amazing show.
That's great.
But you're working on book three of Amos Decker now, right?
Well, I'm thinking about it. What I'm going to do with him next. And right now, I'm working on the next John Polar. It's called No Man's Land. It'll be out in November, and I'm close to finishing that novel right now.
Okay.
And once I do, then I'll start sort of plotting out in my mind about where I want to take Amos Decker next.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought you were already working on three. I guess I was hoping. I was definitely hoping. There's no doubt about that. Do you have an idea of what the story's going to be about?
Well, it'll be obviously a new plot, either with the FBI or maybe it might be a one-off where it's something more personal for him. I like, exploring the relationship that he has with Alex, his sort of sidekick, and how maybe to deepen that. But at the same time, really, I want to get more into Decker's head and let the readers take a peek in there as well. And I also laid the groundwork for this in the first book where just because his brain rewired and he has hyperthymesia now, as the doctors told him, he said the brain is ever evolving, so you may wake up one morning and be totally different. So that's also a challenge.
Ooh.
And something that I want to explore.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I can't wait. Can you tell how excited I am about the next book? I don't know when I've been more excited about a series than I am about this one.
I appreciate that. I share that excitement. I just so glad that I decided to create a character like this because it's been a pleasure for me to write about it.
Now, do you speak a lot at libraries?
I do. I do a lot of speaking engagements around the country, and a lot of the stuff I do are in libraries, and other events too. Obviously, that's a built-in audience for me. Everybody's a reader, and I enjoy that, particularly when it's like a fundraiser. I was in Phoenixville, actually, Pennsylvania, and Mary Higgins Clark was supposed to do this luncheon speak, and it was a fundraiser for the library there, and Mary got ill. So I was going to be in the area anyway to do another event, so I filled in for her.
Oh, how cool. I hope she's feeling better.
I think she is. I think, she's... Mary's a little up there in years, and it's just, I think it got too much.
She's like a national treasure now, really.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The queen.
She's like the Betty White of writers, you know.
She is. She's. I love her. And her daughter, Carol Higgins Clark, they write sometimes together. And Carol's very sweet and takes great care of her mother. So. So, yeah, first thing I got up there when I spoke, I said, okay, just for anybody who's wondering, I'm not Mary Higgins Clark.
that's very cool. That's very fun. I mean, that must be a lot of fun. But they throw these things at you. You never know what is going to get thrown at you. It must be difficult sometimes. You wake up in the morning and you must get 50 phone calls. Can you do this? Can you do that?
Oh, my God. Yeah, my assistant comes in every day with a stack. Every day. And we go through them. And most of them are no's because I need to have time to write. If I accepted all of them, I wouldn't write any books, and nobody would want to speak.
And then everybody would be very angry with you, David.
I know, exactly.
It must be a great feeling to go into a bookstore and see your books just laying there. I mean,
I never get tired of that. I mean, I just never get tired of that. Because for so many years, I was kind of on the outside of the glass looking in, wondering if that would ever going to happen for me. So even now, 20 years later, walking into a store and my nephew sometimes, he's 8 now, and his mom actually works for me. She helps run the charitable organizations, and he goes into the bookstore, and he's like, Mom, there's Uncle David's book, and people, he's like screaming, as 8-year-olds scream, and like looking, going, who the hell is this kid?
That is so cool. And have other people so proud of you, too. I mean, we all want people to be proud of us. I mean, I think it's all built into all of us.
Oh, it is, absolutely.
To want that pride to come through. So what kind of books do you read?
Well, I read all sorts, I'm a big nonfiction style. I just read The Dead Wake, about the sinking of Lusitania.
Oh, wow.
I was on a panel with Eric Larson at NYU a couple of months ago, which is great to meet him. We watched the Hulu series, 11-22-63, based on the Stephen King book.
Oh, yes.
I love the series, and now I'm halfway through the book. I know I'm behind. My wife read it a couple of years ago, and so I'm reading that now, and I just, I've always got a book going, and it's just a big part of my life.
Do you have favorite authors? Do you have authors that you read everything they write?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, and John Irving is probably the classic example of that. I've read everything that Irving has written, and will continue to do so, because every story is so different, but he's just a terrific storyteller.
And quirky. I mean, everything he writes is quirky. I mean, it's never down run-of-the-mill.
No. I mean, he's like one of the most original voices, I think, that we have, and I love, I love thrillers and crime fiction. Patricia Cornwell is terrific. Nelson DeMille, Scott Turow, just a lot of great books out there.
And you get a chance to meet a lot of these people, I'm sure, and it's got to be a thrill.
Yes. Absolutely.
I read you a lot, It's got to be. I mean, just losing Pat Conroy was a major, major blow.
I absolutely was. I didn't even know that he was ill. Kind of like Michael Crichton. I didn't know Michael Crichton was ill until I saw that he had passed. And I was lucky enough to meet Pat 5 or 6 years ago at one of the National Book Festivals. We were on the trolley going over to the event space, and he was telling stories, and I was just sitting there like a little kid listening. It was just amazing.
Hey, it's just, what is it that makes an author so good? And what do you think makes you so good?
I think what makes me so good is that I love to do this, and I know this sounds cliché-ish, but if it's a job, you treat it as a job, and you go in and you do your hours, but you're always thinking about something else you'd rather be doing.
Mm-hmm.
With me, there is nothing else I'd rather be doing than this, and I think it shows through in the pages. It's just kind of like this joy, this enthusiasm, this childlike wonder in the way that I tell stories that I think people like and appreciate, and I've always brought that. It's like I'm an 8-year-old kid cracking open my journal for the first time with my little number 2 pencil, and that's what I do.
Now, what do you do if you're out at a restaurant with your family and you get a really great idea? Do you write it down?
I'll either, take out my phone and tap a note in, or it's just kind of embedded in my head. If I have a really great idea, it's not going anywhere. It's there. I mean, I'm an Amos Decker when it comes to that.
I guess you have to. I mean, sometimes you get a great idea, and you never know when they're going to come.
No, you don't. And you could come over the salad, it could come over the dessert, so you got to be ready.
That's right. It's such a funny thing to think about, but it's true. And with you writing 2 books a year, you have to constantly have ideas. And is that tough sometimes to constantly have ideas?
Yeah, you know, people ask me, where do you get your ideas? And I said, I get them walking down the street. It's not, it's just the way I look at the world. So I see what's out there like everybody else does, but then I try to think of things that could make that scene a lot more special, a lot more unique and original, and to bring out the potential of particular scenes. So if I see two guys walking or talking together on a corner, I don't really just see two guys walking together in a corner. I wonder what they're talking about and what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes after they finish this conversation. Is someone else going to join it? Is someone else going to be taken away from it? So it's like filling out, you know, the rest of the story of what I'm seeing just in real life walking down the street.
All right. Well, we have to let you go. This has been a phenomenal thing. I just enjoy talking to you, dude. You're such a wonderful guy. You really are.
Well, I appreciate it. I enjoyed it. I'm so glad when we get longer to talk, too, because you can really, you know, get in depth on some of these things.
Right. And the book, again, is called The Last Mile from Grand Central Publishing. It's out in all your bookstores now. It's got a beautiful sky cover on it. I love it. The blue is just amazing.
Yeah, people have really noted that, how much they love this cover.
Do you get to pick the covers? I mean, do you actually say, I want this cover? And
yeah, I was actually the one who sort of came up with this design. They had the cover sort of with the house and then a whole bunch of other stuff in it. So I was like, you know what? Let's take a road and run it right up the middle of the house, take out all the other stuff, and that's all we need. And so it turned out to be a great
cover.
You
really do have a great imagination. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Same here, David. I enjoyed it, as always. Look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.